All right, folks, welcome to African Wildlife Foundation. For those of you near and online, it's great to have you at this African Biodiversity Collaborative Group webinar on the Cross River and Gorilla. Today, Richard Berger will take us to Nigeria, but first, I just wanted to point out for logistics, there's some restroom down the hall that way. The front desk could help you navigate further if you get lost, and Jocelyn will give us an ABCG introduction. Thanks.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Jocelyn Zimian, the coordinator at the Africa Biodiversity Collaborative Group. ABCG is a consortium of seven international conservation NGOs with field programs in Africa, and those include African Wildlife Foundation, which is kind enough to host us today, Conservation International, the Jane Goodall Institute, the Nature Conservancy, Wildlife Conservation Society, World Resources Institute, and World Wildlife Fund. ABCG's mission is to tackle complex and changing conservation challenges by catalyzing and strengthening collaboration and bringing the best resources from across the continuum of conservation organizations to effectively and efficiently work toward this vision in Africa. We operate through a generous grant from the U.S. Agency for International Development's FATS program and from contributions from ILO members. And today we have Dr. Rich Burgle from the North Carolina Zoological Society. And I, a couple logistical things on my end too. I have a couple sign-on sheets going around, so please keep them going. Please make sure you sign in. For those of you joining on the webinar, we will have a Q&A session at the end of the at the end of the presentation. So for remote participants, if you would like to ask a question, you can do so using the question function on the webinar program. Let's see. And I think that's everything. So please sign in, and thanks for coming.
Great. Well, thanks for the introduction, and thanks to all of you for the opportunity to share some of the work that we've been involved with in partnership with WCS in Nigeria for, I guess, about 6-7 years now. I'm going to be talking about a smaller component of a much larger project focused on the Cross River Gorilla, but I thought I'd give, because it's a part of Africa that not many people are that familiar with, I thought I'd give a brief introduction to the region as a whole. The Cross River Gorilla landscape is part of a much larger block of tropical forest, often referred to as the Gulf of Guinea forest, which is, depending on how you define it, the largest or second largest forest block remaining in West Africa. But it's also relatively poorly studied compared to, certainly compared to Central or Southern or East Africa. Biological research still just getting started in this part of the continent. Similarly, concerted conservation action here is relatively recent. Nigeria has had a National Park Service for a long time, going back to the colonial days, but it's only within the last 10, perhaps 15 years that international NGO engagement has ramped up the activity of conservation in the region. And then this is also a very important area in terms of the biological importance. It's a region of very high species richness and is endemism for a wide variety of different taxa. Particularly for primates, this is the primate hotspot in Africa. It has very high primate species richness and the largest number of endemic taxa on the entire continent. This includes things like the drill. The Nigeria Cameroon chimpanzee are a relatively recently described distinct subspecies of chimpanzee, only found in, obviously, Nigeria and Cameroon. Poises guenon, an arboreal monkey that's endemic to the highlands of this region. And then the Cross River Gorilla, which I'll be talking about in greater detail. But it's not just primates. I'm a primatologist, but this is also a very important place for birds. There are 26 endemic species found in the forests of this region. Two monotypic genera and three species that are known only from a single locality in this region. There's things like Ursula's mouse-colored sunbird and a the frugivorous Bannerman's turaco. Amphibians, this is probably, there are 52 endemic species found in these, in the forests and highlands of this region. It's a really incredible place for amphibians. And this is despite the fact that there actually hasn't been that much work done on this group. So it's likely that there's a lot more out there that we're not aware of, including things like the evocatively named black long-fingered frog and the equally evocatively named Cameron slippery frog. So, but all this biodiversity occurs in what is a very challenging environment for conservation. This part of Africa has one of the highest rates of forest loss and fragmentation on the continent, in addition to those high levels of biodiversity. Plantations are a particular threat. Palm oil is increasingly moving into this part of Africa, particularly in Cameroon. Some of the largest banana plantations on the continent are in this landscape. And the pressures on the forest for plantation space are increasing. Small-scale agriculture, though, is probably the number one threat because it's such a densely populated part of the continent. The pressure for land, for people to grow crops, is really intense. In the forest itself, there's a lot of collection of non-timber forest products like chewing sticks and cattle sticks. Chewing sticks are used as toothbrushes, cattle sticks for hitting cows with. And then luckily, there's a relatively low levels of at least commercial timber exploitation, although there is some artisanal local timbering going on. Bushmeat is the other big threat, like a lot of other forest systems in Central and West Africa. People in this region rely on forest animals for a lot of their protein. Some of my Nigerian friends joke that Nigerians will eat anything with four legs except for a table and a chair, and that's definitely true. Just about any forest animal is exploited for protein. And then, as I said, all this is happening in what is one of the most densely, most densely populated parts of Africa. And Nigeria is Africa's most populous country, and despite its enormous size, it's the second most densely populated country in Africa. So all these people really exacerbate those problems. Which brings me to the Cross River gorilla. Cross River gorilla is a critically endangered primate. It's the most endangered of the four different African apes. The mountain gorillas that most people are very familiar with have about twice as many animals remaining in the wild as the Cross River gorilla. We have only about 300 somewhere between 200 and 300 Cross River gorillas remaining in the landscape, which stretches across the border between Nigeria and Cameroon. And the gorillas are found mostly in relatively isolated highland sites, although work has suggested that the entire landscape appears to be good gorilla habitat. The gorillas are only found in these very rugged and remote areas, probably as a result of hunting. It's obviously a lot more difficult to access these highland sites than the lowlands, and we do see a lot more intense hunting in lowland areas. So their current distribution and current population size is almost certainly the result of exploitation hunting by humans. There is a long history of hunting of these animals. Genetic research suggests that the population was considerably larger until only about 200 or so years ago. And that the current very small size of the population is therefore a recent contraction that's probably associated with the introduction of firearms into the region. Until people had guns, it would have been a much more difficult proposition for local people to hunt gorillas, which from a conservation perspective is relatively good news, if you can call a small population size good news, because genetically they still have a reasonable level of diversity. And because the population contraction, the bottleneck, is relatively recent, if the population can expand, the threat presented by things like inbreeding is mitigated. And like the broader region, although this is certainly changing, these gorillas are poorly studied compared to, say, Western lowland gorillas or mountain gorillas. There's been relatively little research on the population as a whole, some genetic research, some ecological research, some basic survey work, a little bit on on habitat requirements, but really compared to other gorillas, which are very intensively studied, very little done. So as I said, there's somewhere between 200 and 300 cross river gorillas remaining in the wild. Getting a decent estimate of the population has been a real challenge, and we still don't have one, and that's why there's such a wide range for such a small number. They're found in roughly 11 different highland areas, and our understanding of the gorilla's distribution has really changed a lot, even in relatively recent history. So just back in 2000, which is about when I started working on them, they were only known from about 7 sites and from very limited areas. And that area has now, that we know that the gorillas use, has expanded by about 300% in the last 13 years. So we're still really trying to better understand what is going on with this population. And the reason for not knowing more precisely how many gorillas there are in the forest is that, number one, as I said, it's very rugged and remote, hard to access. Because of the long history of hunting, the gorillas are very cryptic. They really avoid people. So I spent, when I was doing my PhD, I spent about 2 years in the forest, and I only saw them 3 times for a total observation time of about 7 seconds. So it's not like mountain gorillas, Diane Fossey, gorilla cuddling kind of thing. It's very rarely actually see the animals, which makes them obviously very hard to survey. Also, this landscape is really large. It's about 2,000 square kilometers of forest that the gorillas occur in. Again, as a point of contrast for a gorilla population people might be more familiar with, the mountain gorillas in the Virunga area occur in about 300 square kilometers or 400 square kilometers of forest. So it's a much, much bigger area and much more rugged. So people often go to see the mountain gorillas and talk about how tough the trekking was there and how difficult things were there. The average slope in the areas where the gorillas are here is double what it is in the mountain gorilla region. So it's a tough, Dirk can tell you, it's a tough, tough place to trek. Cross river gorillas, another thing that makes them unique are they're the only African ape that for which there has been a revised IUCN action plan. So most of the African apes have IUCN action plans, but after the 5 years of the initial action plan, we have recently gone through and revised this to take another look at conservation priorities for this subspecies. And part of the reason for doing this is that we had actually been relatively successful in the conservation priorities identified in the initial action plan. 3 new protected areas across the landscape have been created. We, as I said, we have a much better understanding now of the gorilla's range, which was one of the real challenges in planning conservation actions. If you don't know where the things are, it's very hard to conserve them. What I'm going to be talking about today, we've significantly enhanced wildlife law enforcement and monitoring. When work started in the Cross River region, there was very little being done in terms of law enforcement. Most of what was being done was basic survey work and ecological research. And partly as a result of creating this initial action plan, there's now much better transboundary collaboration between Nigeria and Cameroon. Nigeria and Cameroon have a somewhat difficult history. They were actually fighting a war in a different part of the border region until quite recently. And the Cross River Gorilla and the creation of the action plan were a way that a variety of the different people involved with their conservation were able to bring the two governments together. And now there are, at least until Ebola and the border was closed, regular transboundary patrols done by rangers from Cross River National Park and Takamanda National Park in Cameroon. So all facilitated by the action plan. And another thing that's real, and this is it also plays into what I'll be talking about in greater detail today, there's been a lot more community involvement in Cross River gorilla conservation. Until relatively recently, it was mostly NGOs and government being involved, but there has been significant outreach to a number of the different communities living throughout the Cross River landscape to engage them with the conservation of these animals, ranging from community gorilla monitors through a program called the Gorilla Guardian Program that WCS runs in Cameroon, to what I'll be talking about today, an entire community wildlife sanctuary that is owned and more or less run by the communities that surround it. So the focus of my talk today is going to be just one small part of the entire Cross River Gorilla landscape called the Mbe Mountains Community Wildlife Sanctuary. This is a relatively small area, about 100 square kilometers on the Nigeria side of the gorilla's distribution. found in between the large Cross River National Park, which is along the border with Cameroon, and Athi Mountain Wildlife Sanctuary, which is a state-run wildlife sanctuary where the gorillas also occur. This is managed by a community conservation association, so it's unique in the landscape in that it's the only non-government protected area where the gorillas occur. And it's a really important site for Cross River gorillas, not just because there is a population of gorillas here, but because it acts as a corridor between the westernmost population of gorillas here at Athi, then the gorillas in Cross River National Park, and then in the broader landscape. So Mbe is important in terms of habitat connectivity and population connectivity for the gorillas. And at present, there are 13 eco-guards or rangers who are responsible for patrolling the sanctuary, who are managed jointly by the community association and the Wildlife Conservation Society. WCS provides basically the daily management, and the community association provides them, gives them their broader remit for the work that they do in the sanctuary. It isn't just law enforcement in Mbe, though. There's a number of other community-focused initiatives like alternative livelihoods and conservation education that WCS is running in the 9 communities around Mbe. So while the forest itself doesn't have any communities inside, there are almost all the way around, except for the border with the national park, there are communities and farmland just about all the way around the perimeter. So in initiating this protection program at Mbe, there were two questions that seem pretty simple, but are obviously fundamental to determining whether or not this approach for conserving the gorillas at this site was effective. So number one, we wanted to look at have a ranger patrol has been successful in reducing threats to wildlife, and obviously particularly gorillas. And then how have wildlife populations responded? So, you know, the threat side of things and then the biological or wildlife side of things. And I think most of you are, if not all of you, are professional conservationists, so are very familiar with these types of questions that all of us ask. But it seems like these questions don't actually often get answered that often, even though they are fundamental indicators of whether or not we're being successful, because they're very challenging. These aren't necessarily easy questions to answer. So the approach that we took was to put in place a monitoring system using cyber tracker software. This is a software that was developed in South Africa originally for illiterate Kunsan Bushmen to be able to collect information about wildlife tracks that they were finding in the Kalahari. The way that it's a very flexible system, but the way we set it up was to use touchscreen based data collection, like I have a few devices if people are interested in seeing them, where rangers tap in information onto the screen about what they're observing in the field, and then the devices also collect an automated track log that happens independent of any user interaction with the device. The way that the system works and the way the devices collect data is that observational data, so whether you see a snare or a gorilla nest site or something like that, you collect a variety of different attribute data about those, and then those attribute data are automatically linked to coordinate data, to the GPS point where that thing, that phenomenon was observed. It's not just data collection, though. It also incorporates a database and analysis component that allows for reasonably straightforward analysis by non-specialists. So people who have a basic knowledge of computers can take the data from the field, download the data, bring them into a database, and calculate things like encounter rates. They can make maps, do summaries of patrol effort, and so on. And the system was set up to basically monitor 3 different things. So certainly to monitor wildlife, that's our primary concern, is what's going on with the wildlife in the forest, but also threats, because those things, the status of wildlife is obviously integrally linked to threats. And then lastly, ranger performance. So a number of sites in the Cross River landscape, probably not unlike sites you're familiar with, there had been a lot of ranger quote unquote activity going on, but nobody really knew what the effort was. Once you send guys out of headquarters and they go into the forest, do they go 10 kilometers? Do they go 5 kilometers? Do they go 1 kilometer? Do they patrol the same area every time they go out? Are they making an effort? Are they not making an effort? Are they doing what they're told to or not? So there was definitely a staff management component to this, in addition to a biomonitoring component. So what I'm going to be presenting today are data that were collected by community rangers over the course of 5 years during anti-poaching patrols. So these aren't line transects. These aren't surveys using recces. This is guys who are on patrol just recording information in the course of their patrols. And while they're on patrol, they are tasked with recording all evidence of both wildlife that they see within certain parameters, not every single porcupine track, but sightings of wildlife, sounds of wildlife, wildlife dung, that kind of thing. Also any threats, so snares, shotgun cartridges, gunshots heard, people that they encounter, machete cuts where hunters have been marking their tracks, that kind of thing. And then also the automated track log, which just is mapping where they go on a daily basis. So over these 5 years, we have almost 15,000 kilometers of patrols walked. So it's quite a lot of patrolling for an area that's only 100 square kilometers. And what we saw over the course of this project, or at least the project to date, is since we started, a 100% increase in the number of patrol days. So as the program has developed and evolved, and more effort has been put on managing the patrol teams, we've seen a big increase in our measure of patrol effort, i.e. number of patrols, and then also the distance walked. So it's not just that they're going out more days, but they're covering more ground when they're on patrol. So in terms of threat, there were a couple of different indices of hunting that we looked at. And in terms of expended shotgun cartridges, shotgun hunting is the primary means of hunting in these forests, at least for medium and large mammals. We saw a statistically significant decrease in the number of shells that were being encountered in the forest. And these are just new shells that are found on the floor of the forest, so not old rusty ones that may have been there for a long time. There was some suggestion that, well, now that hunters know that they're being monitored, perhaps they're picking up their cartridges so that there's less evidence of their activities out in the forest. So we also looked at the gunshots that were heard over the course of patrols. And these also have decreased in a statistically significant fashion over the 5 years of the project. But not everything is hunted with shotgun shells. There's a lot of snaring that goes on in these forests. In the Afi Reserve, which is kind of across the street from Mbe, in the first year, this isn't data that are shown here, but in the first year of that, or the first month of that project, they pulled out 3,000 snares. So there's a lot of hunting going on in these forests. The snaring rate at Mbe has historically been much lower, but the rate of snares encountered by the patrol teams has also gone down significantly, to the point now where it's very rare to find snares at all. But it may be, playing devil's advocate, it may be that the reason that we're seeing these reductions in threat is because the wildlife populations have become so denuded that people just aren't hunting anymore because it's not worth their while. So we looked also at a number of different animal groups, and what we found for duikers, so forest antelopes, is that more or less the encounter rate for those has stayed the same. There's no significant change over time in duiker encounter rate. And then for monkeys, similarly, staying more or less the same, although you'll see that there is a fair amount of spread here in terms of the month-to-month encounter rates. Taking all monkeys together in terms of how often they're sighted, it has stayed pretty consistent across the 5 years. But the other thing that we looked at with monkeys is looking at the frequency of both sightings and calls. We had a suspicion that, like the gorillas, the monkeys were altering their behavior somewhat in response to heavy levels of hunting and being more cryptic than they would normally, and avoiding people get running away from people as soon as they were nearby. And obviously monkeys are much better at seeing people in the forest than people are at seeing monkeys. So when we combine those data together, there actually is a slight increase in the encounter rate of signs of monkeys if you include calls as well. And then if you break that down by species, by the four most common species, there are differences. And this is actually what has been seen at other sites in the region where when you look at individual species, mona monkeys, which are probably the most generalist, most flexible animals, actually do see a gradual increase over time, whereas the animals which are typically a little bit more susceptible to hunting, certainly things like drills, have lower reproductive rates, are larger bodied, so are targeted more frequently by hunters. Those ones are the ones that are staying more or less the same, or perhaps even showing a slight decrease. We can't put all of this on the increase in patrol effort, though. As I said, there's a number of other conservation interventions going on in the Mbe region. This is a community reserve, so the communities, to at least a certain extent, are bought into the idea of having a protected area on their land. None of the work that's being done there would be possible without the agreement of the communities. So that although there are frequently disagreements between the community group that is responsible for the sanctuary and WCS, the de facto manager of the sanctuary, they are at least at a basic level bought into the existence of the sanctuary. Conservation education is a big part of what WCS does throughout the landscape, but especially in Mbe, where the relationships with the community are quite strong. And then there's also been a variety of different alternative livelihood projects focused on hunters active in the Mbe Mountains that involve exchanging guns for training and things like beekeeping and snail farming. Like I'm sure all of you encounter in your work, we have lots of challenges working in the Cross River landscape in general and Mbe in general, or in specifically. Funding is obviously one. The rangers are paid by WCS with grant money. So that's not what at least some people would call a sustainable way to run a protected area. I would probably argue, and maybe this is a topic for discussion, that most of what we do isn't sustainable and that we have to agree that that's okay. And that's kind of our business model, is that we will continue to look for money to make these things work and continue to have engagement at sites like this. Rather than saying, "Well, we're going to fix everything in the 5 years of a grant, and then we'll go away and it'll just go on its own merry way," I don't think that is realistic, at least not in places like Cross River State in Nigeria. This whole system relies on electronics, so all the data are collected with mobile devices like this. So even though, and I'll talk about this a little bit more in a second. Even though we are buying rugged, you know, totally waterproof, shockproof, dustproof military specification devices, they still get broken. They still run out of power, and they're not cheap. So in order to keep the system running, there has to be kind of a continual infusion of both funding and technical support in order to keep it. To keep the field teams collecting data. There are some limitations to the CyberTracker software package that we've been using. It's a software that's been around for a long time, and the analysis functionality hasn't developed as much as perhaps you'd like to see over that period of time. It's also, because it's set up to be a very flexible software package, it's not designed for doing law enforcement monitoring per se. It's designed to collect any kind of data. So you can collect disaster relief data, health data, village surveys, behavioral data, all kinds of things with it. So because of that, it's not really set up to just spit out monthly encounter rates or monthly patrol effort or something like that. It involves a little bit more back-end analysis. In both Nigeria and Cameroon, Both capacity, technical capacity is relatively low. The Nigerian secondary education system has not quite collapsed, but is really not doing very well. There aren't many people getting degrees in conservation biology or something similar, and then people who are getting training with computers and so on want to work for banks and oil companies and that kind of thing, not WCS Nigeria. So it involved and still involves a lot of external technical support in order to maintain this project. And then lastly, maybe you noticed, there was no direct measure of impact on the gorilla population, which is really what we care about. And that's because these gorillas are at present at such low densities that, as I said, you very, very rarely actually see them. Counting number of nests isn't really a great way to measure what's going on with the gorilla population. And so we still, unfortunately, don't have a great idea of whether or not our primary target in this project is actually being positively affected by the work that we're doing. But I would argue that the threats to gorillas, so snares, the primary threats to gorillas, snares and gun hunting, have been reduced. So it's not too much of a stretch to think that the gorilla population is being positively impacted. So just to summarize the findings from the Cyber Tracker law enforcement monitoring work that we've been doing, because wildlife encounter rates seem to be more or less stable, or in some cases maybe increasing, it does suggest that the patterns that we're seeing in terms of reduction of threat are the result of the positive impact of patrolling rather than the empty forest syndrome where there's no animals left, so people have given up or are significantly reducing the amount of hunting that they're doing. As I said, some species do appear to rebound faster than others. One of the monkey species does seem to be increasing in population already, whereas the duikers and the other monkeys are more or less just maintaining status quo. That being said, not just primate encounter rates, but encounter rates for all wildlife in these forests are very, very low. The encounter rate for each of the primate species is, give or take, somewhere around 0.1 per kilometer walked, which is 10 times lower than a healthy forest, or maybe even a little bit more. The island of Bioko, just across the water from this landscape, routinely records 2 monkeys encounters per kilometer walked during surveys. So that even though the animals are still there and populations are following what seems to be a positive trajectory, they're still at very low densities. It does seem like there's probably some effect of seasonality. If you were looking at the points on the graph, there's a lot of up and down there, which may be seasonal. There's also a lot of scatter because these are primarily ranger patrols. They're not research teams going out to survey primates. They're going out primarily to enforce laws and community regulations about what's allowed in the forest. There's a lot less precision in these data than you would have if these were line transects or recces or something like that. So the data are likely not as precise as one would get with a concerted survey. But ultimately, it is possible to, with a comprehensive and also well-monitored program, that you can reduce the threats to primates and other wildlife in tropical forests. Community participation is very important at other sites like the Cross River National Park, which is adjacent to Mbe, where there's very little, if any, community engagement with conservation. There's been no positive increase like we've seen at Mbe. But obviously, as I said, decreasing reduction in threats is easier than showing a positive effect on wildlife populations. But I think given the short terms that, counter to what I said about 5-year grants and so on, given the short terms that these kinds of projects are often operating under, it's not realistic, I don't think, to say that we're going to increase the population of whatever target species by 15% over the course of the project. I think it's more realistic to say we're going to reduce threats. And because of the lack of precision in the types of ranger data that we're collecting, these types of projects need to be supplemented also by more rigorous, more scientific study to go out and actually calculate, if not densities, at least more precise encounter rates of animals in the landscape. But this is one of the very few sites, certainly in Central and West Africa, certainly in tropical forests of Africa, where at least some threat to wildlife population has been documented. There are very few places that are able to say that the threats over what is actually a pretty modest period of time, 5 years, have been reduced. There's a number of different things that contributed to what I would call the success of this project. First of all, was the use of this mobile device-based monitoring system. They're using paper and pencil for a variety of personality-based, but also logistical reasons would have been impossible. Even though the logistics of keeping devices like this running in the forest are quite challenging, it's actually much harder to get working pens and paper into the forest in one of the wettest places in the world. And there's a certain amount of psychology involved too. A lot of the rangers that we're working with, if you give them what is basically a child's exercise book and a few pencils, they don't feel like their work are being particularly valued. But when you hand somebody something that costs $2,000 and is obviously expensive and fancy and different to something that anything that they've been given before, they feel like they're being invested in. And we even have guys that are used in the forest have a carrying case and a neck strap. And we even have guys just wearing them around the village when they're not on patrol, which isn't great because things can happen to them when they're being just worn around the village, but they just wear them around. And when there are issues with the communities, when communities get irritated with what's going on in the forest, these things are the first things that they confiscate. They go into the camps and they don't take the machetes or uniforms or the solar system or whatever. They take these. So there's a certain amount of non-technical, political cachet or prestige. Thank you. Yeah, exactly. To using these devices. Also key to this was that the whole data collection system took a long time to develop because it was developed in very close consultation with every level of person who was involved with it. So from the rangers on the ground to the sort of mid-level managers to the country directors, they were all involved in not just what is it data are important, but what makes sense to you in terms of how you collect it. So there was a similar project a few years before this that tried to use mobile devices for doing ranger-based monitoring. And they used, it was more symbol-based, and they were recording information about what animals were eating. And they had an icon for when an animal was eating fruit, they had an icon of an apple. So, because of course that makes sense, right? They're eating fruit. But none of the guys who were using the device had ever seen an apple before. So they had no idea what that was. And there was all kinds of things like that, like these very sort of, I don't know, Western ideas about what cognitively makes sense that didn't translate at all. And so that project just collapsed because nobody collected the information, didn't make any sense to people. And so we used all local terms for animals and tried to put different types of information together in a way that made sense to the people that were doing the data collection, not necessarily in the way that they made sense to us, at least on the front end. All that got kind of changed around and analyzed differently on the desktop. But it was very important for the data collectors to feel like they understood what they were doing and that they had some investment in how the whole thing was created. Testing of these things, we spent months and months testing devices to see which ones held up the best under the very difficult conditions that they do encounter. Occasionally get them back where it's been obvious that somebody's been like cutting onions on the screen in camp, which is not the best thing for a touchscreen. I've gotten them back with machete cuts. We've gotten them back that have fallen off the backs of motorcycles. So, yeah, you need a tough device. And that's why investment in the appropriate hardware is really important. Whenever I talk to people at AWF, other organizations, and we say, yeah, for every one of these is $2,000. There's a lot of sticker shock on this. Well, I can buy a Garmin for $100. But these last much longer, and what you get out of them is so much greater in terms of how the data, reliability of data collection, time saved in terms of data entry, accuracy in terms of transcription errors and so on. It's really worth it, but it is an investment. But again, I would argue that, you know, most of us for our field vehicles wouldn't go out and buy a Toyota Corolla. We would go and buy a Hilux or a Land Cruiser because that's what you need to get to the forest. And I would say that it's kind of the same thing with ranger-based monitoring. As I said, technical support is a big part of this. I've remained engaged with this project on a very regular basis, providing technical support, fixing problems when they come up. And I think that's just the reality of employing a solution like this. I don't know what to do about that. I'll just leave it there. The alternative is we wouldn't be collecting any data. So, and then also this has a very applied focus. This isn't a research project. This isn't anybody's PhD. We are collecting data that are directly relevant for the management of the patrol program and for the management of the sanctuary. Just as an aside, the zoo. I'll just keep going because I think we're doing okay for time. This was the first. The Cross River Landscape was the first cyber tracker based law enforcement monitoring project that we engaged with. But the relative success of the project has grown into a number of other related projects using CyberTracker. Also in Nigeria, we work in Yankari Game Reserve with WCS. This is where the last viable population of elephants is found in Nigeria. Again, very similar program, monitoring what's going on with rangers, monitoring what's going on with threats, monitoring what's going on with elephants and other wildlife. We've put in place a CyberTracker-based system on the island of Bioko, part of Equatorial Guinea, for monitoring primate populations there. Last year, working with Diane Fossey Gorilla Fund, we set up their anti-poaching teams with CyberTracker, and I'm actually going to Rwanda next month to help set up a CyberTracker-based system for doing the five-yearly mountain gorilla census in that landscape. We're working with Panthera to do lion surveys at multiple sites, especially in West Africa, but also elsewhere on the continent. And then in Tanzania's Ruaha National Park, slightly different approach, working with the Ruaha Carnivore Project to monitor carnivores, monitor carnivores using lodge drivers rather than rangers, because there's so many of them out there, they're just recording every time they see some kind of carnivore. So they increase the database on carnivore sightings. And then a new vulture project, doing vulture surveys in Ruaha as well, because vultures seem like they're on the way out in that landscape. So despite the successes that we've had with CyberTracker, it definitely isn't perfect. Some kind of nuts and bolts things, like there's no manual for the software, you just have to learn it, and very little in the way of supporting materials. There's no formal training available in CyberTracker. You can't go to a CyberTracker workshop unless you organize it. As I said, the analysis functionality is a little bit limited. There's a lot of things that we want to do, especially in the context of law enforcement monitoring, that it doesn't do. It has a relatively basic database structure, which again makes querying and analysis a little bit challenging. And the mapping functionality, although it's there, is a little bit limited. You can make maps, but they're not particularly pretty. And it's also a kind of a single user application. You just have it on the software, and you open up the database, and you're into it. So you can't have different an administrator and then a mid-level user and a data entry user and that sort of thing, which as projects grow and certainly for larger protected areas is a necessity. So, which brings me to kind of the future, at least in terms of our engagement with law enforcement monitoring, which is SMART. I'm sure many of you have already heard about SMART, the spatial monitoring and reporting tool. Not the name that I would have chosen, but that's what we're stuck with now. SMART was created by a consortium of NGOs, including us, about 4 years ago. The initial release was about 2.5 years ago, and now we have SMART 3.03 coming out at the beginning of next month, which adds a lot of functionality. And SMART is really very different from CyberTracker and MIST, the other probably even better known existing LEM tool. But everything that is in SMART has come out of our various experiences with CyberTracker, with MIST, ArcGIS, and all the other things that people had been using to do law enforcement monitoring up until recently. SMART allows for much more powerful analysis and much more focused analysis on the kinds of things that we care about, because it was designed from the ground up as a law enforcement monitoring software, not just a data collection software. SMART has a great automated report generation function. So basically, once the protected area managers or the various people involved decide that this is what we want in our quarterly report, our annual report, our patrol report, you basically click a couple of buttons and the whole thing gets spit out in either as a PDF or a Word document with maps, text, statistics, graphs, and so on. So it takes very little input from the user once it's all set up. It does allow for multiple users, so you can have people who can just enter data, but then who can't mess with the data, who can't access the data, who can't produce reports, or all the way up to the administrator, who can obviously do everything. Related to that, there's a lot more data security and data controls in SMART than in CyberTracker, which especially in some protected areas is very important. If you're monitoring where your ranger teams are going in a place like Kruger National Park, where there's a lot of pressure on things like rhinos and where the poaching effort is very concerted and sophisticated, you don't want somebody to be able to just go into the database and send off information for this is where we're planning on sending patrols next month. SMART was developed with a plugin framework so it's very easy to add on functionality to SMART. One of the things we did last year was to develop a plugin for CyberTracker so that we can collect data with the CyberTracker interface, which is really a great, very straightforward, intuitive interface, and then just pull the data straight into SMART so to take advantage of the analytical and reporting functionality of SMART. SMART is open source, unlike MIST and CyberTracker, so you're free to develop your own modules or make your own changes to it if you like, although we would obviously prefer that you worked with us in order to make those available to the whole community. And it's very easy to use. As I said, things like reporting and analysis can be more or less automated once the system is set up. SMART also, because it was designed from a law enforcement perspective, includes things like intelligence and patrol planning information, which other solutions don't. It's available in multiple languages, so Spanish, French, Thai, Russian, all kinds of different languages, which the other solutions aren't. It allows you to aggregate data from multiple protected areas into a single database. So if you have a national park headquarters in the capital, they can be bringing in data from multiple different sites. And there's a lot of well-developed tech support and training materials. So basically, all the sites that we're engaged with, we're going to be transitioning to SMART for all our law enforcement monitoring work. And are also interested in building SMART capacity at other protected areas across Africa. We're looking at this, something we talking to Fish and Wildlife Service about doing some comparisons between data collected by SMART, with SMART, and data collected by other sources of information like acoustic monitors, so to compare ranger-based data versus these other perhaps more independent sources of data. But we will continue with CyberTracker for some other projects. So for something that's purely research-related, in many ways, CyberTracker is still a good or better solution. So thank you for your attention, and yeah, I'd be happy to take some questions.
Thanks. I assume the rangers here are armed.
They are not, no.
So the national parks are not armed?
Well, it varies. So at Mbe, the community wildlife sanctuary, they are not armed. Okay. They carry machetes, but more just to cut their way through the forest. In the national park, they are armed, and then in the wildlife sanctuary, they're not armed. So most of the cross river protected areas where cross river gorillas are found, they're not armed.
So then, what's the authority for the eco guards to apprehend if they do come across hunters or predators? Mm-hmm. What's their authority in apprehending, and how often are?
Well, that's where the community part of it comes in. So because it's a community sanctuary, and because of the vast majority of people active in the forest doing things illegally are members of those communities, they know everybody. So they know, if they see somebody in the forest, they know who that person is, and that person knows them, and if the person runs away or fights them or whatever event, they all have to go home at the end of the day or the end of the week, and they're still part of that community. So so all the enforcement is done at that community level. There's very little, at least at Mbe, in terms of enforcement of national laws. people are arrested because they violated one of the rules of the sanctuary that are established by the community, and then they're punished within the community. They're not taken to jail or anything. They're fined or beaten. But it's traditional. They basically go to like a traditional court, and the traditional court just decides on the penalty.
Okay. So if someone was caught hunting a monkey or even a gorilla in the community sanctuary, they would face the community's penalties and not.
If it was a gorilla, no, it would probably be escalated to the police would get involved because that's a much more serious infraction, even within national law, than just being found in the sanctuary with a gun or something like that. So because it's actually like technically not illegal to be in the forest with a gun. Like that's not, according to Nigerian law, that's not illegal. But it's against the rules of the sanctuary that everybody who lives in the sanctuary and who owns a sanctuary has agreed on. So in some ways, the rules are more strict than they would be in, like in a forest reserve, for example.
Did you recall any poaching of gorillas during this
incident? I think there was one incident. But it's not clear if it was from here or from the. It was probably from the sanctuary, the state wildlife sanctuary, kind of across the way.
Well, I have two questions. The first question is, so the poachers that are based in the community, the animals they're poaching, is it for local consumption or are they sort of trafficking it elsewhere, selling it elsewhere?
Mm-hmm.
And then the second question I have is, so when you look at the sort of contributors to success, they're all sort of like targeting the success of like the monitoring itself. But what about the success of like actually, you know, how did you get the success of actually bringing down the threats, you know, like the amount of gunshots heard or the amount of snares found?
Mm-hmm.
And specifically, I'm interested in the sort of alternative livelihoods, you know, like how much were you able to really like convert former hunters to like beekeeping? You know,
right.
Are they open to that? Where do they make more money? You know,
So the first question, it's a common, in terms of bushmeat hunting, it's a combination of local consumption and market hunting. I would very roughly, I would guess it's probably 25% local consumption, 75% for sale. All these communities are quite close to roads, and there are good conduits for bringing meat out, and all the meat is smoked, so it can travel long distances. It's probably not internationally, but going to, there's a city of about 1 million people about 5 hours away. So that's a big market. And there's millions and millions of people in Nigeria. So there's no lack of market for bushmeat in Nigeria. And also nobody's looked at this in detail, but the fact that almost all the meat that you see is smoked suggests that it's going to markets. If people were consuming it locally, they would just consume it fresh. In terms of looking at contributors to success, my guess is that the main reason for the approximate reason for reduction in threats is because the law enforcement was happening, because snares were being removed, people were being arrested, guns were being confiscated, people were being fined. So it became a less attractive proposition for people. Hunting, even though there was a fair amount of it going on, isn't the main source of employment for people. People are primarily agriculturalists. So you're not affecting, so if you start enforcing rules or laws about hunting, you're not affecting a massive portion of the population. It's a relatively small number of people. They're having a pretty big impact. And also many people from the community would then actually benefited from people being arrested, because those people would have to pay a fine to the community, and that would be used for construction of a community hall or buying crates of beer for the community or whatever. So there's some incentive for the communities to enforce the regulations. And there's a third part to that?
Kind of like self-point, just like the alternative livelihood.
Oh yeah. I don't, off the top of my head, I couldn't give any good numbers for that. There have been probably dozens of guns turned in the context. So in order for people to participate in the alternative livelihood projects, they have to turn in a gun, because it's targeting hunters. and they don't want to just give people a way to, that they can buy more shotgun shells. So they have to turn in guns, and there have been lots and lots of guns turned in, but I don't have the numbers off the top of my head.
We're going to take a question from the remote participant.
Okay.
How might new Earth imaging technologies, for instance, satellites taking images daily, interact with, support, or replace mobile technology?
I don't think that they can. There's a limit to how much data you can collect with a remote sensor, no matter how sophisticated it is, in a rainforest, because it doesn't penetrate the canopy, or almost, there's very little that penetrates the canopy. You might be able to get heat signatures from fires, but unless you were using something like synthetic aperture radar that could really get down below the canopy, you're not going to see what's going on down there. And even then, that's going to be outrageously difficult and expensive to do. So I think there isn't really, at least at present, there isn't really a substitute for having people on the ground doing law enforcement work, and the way to monitor both the threats to wildlife and also the law enforcement people is I think in the foreseeable future anyway, going to be these kinds of mobile devices. That being said, I think there is a big role for remotely sensed data in this type of work for tracking things like obviously forest loss or conversion. But at least in the short term, I think we're still going to be using mobile devices.
That follows your last point. Just to wonder about forest loss. Mm-hmm. You talked about the different primates not responding very strongly to the changes and the threats.
Mm-hmm.
Have other things stayed the same, like habitat loss around the sanctuary or presence of people in the sanctuary, other things that would be possibly affecting monkey populations or bird populations?
Presence of people has reduced because most things aren't allowed in the forest anymore, so people are going to the forest less. And some NTFP collection is still allowed, so people go into the forest to collect various plants. And forest loss is definitely still an issue. When the sanctuary was created, the communities insisted on boundaries that were less than what had been suggested 20 years ago when the area was being considered for inclusion in the national park. So there's a lot of forest that is technically outside the sanctuary that is being lost or that likely will be lost because it's not within the sanctuary. But within the sanctuary itself, very little. And part of that is because it's very steep and rugged, so it's not great for farming or logging or something like that.
It's great to see the decline in threat. Is there an effort to normalize the threat in by control effort? Which obviously you have a greater opportunity to see threats.
Right.
All things equal, you would see actually an increase in threat with control effort if threats were on the ground.
Well, it's good. Well, the threat is encounter rate, so it's controlled. It controls for effort.
Okay.
So it's the number of shotgun shells per kilometer walked. So
right.
As patrol effort increases, obviously, yeah, you would definitely see an increase in number of shotgun shells. But it's basically number of shotgun shells divided by distance walked. So yeah.
And second question. Elaborate a little bit on adaptive management decision making that the monitoring input on the ground.
It's been not as much as we would like to see or would be possible. It's been basically sort of at the end of the month looking at a map and saying, okay, all the patrols have been in the south, you guys should go to the north. It would be a lot more. The management would be a lot more frequent and detailed and, much more concerted effort to be a little bit more strategic about that, how that works. But it's a process. I think part of the reason why that hasn't happened as much is a technical one related to CyberTracker, because the reporting is a little bit more laborious in CyberTracker than it would be in SMART. So with SMART, you can basically set up, as you know, you can set up a patrol report, and as soon as the patrol team comes back, you plug your device in, you click, three or four buttons, and the patrol report comes out, and then you have it, and you can sit down, with it. You could have the patrol leader come in and sit there for 5 minutes and have the report printed out and then discuss it, Whereas with CyberTracker, it's more like, you know, it's kind of a day-long process to get all the stuff together and put into a Word document and all that kind of thing. So, and it probably also, there's a certain amount of staff capacity there as well. It's the staff who are managing the Rangers, we could probably deal with some slightly higher level staff that have a little bit more initiative or willingness to be tough with the field guys. There's sort of a tricky balance because these guys also go on patrol with them. So, you know, when you spend a month at a time in the forest with people, you tend to become friends with them, and you know, they're all, and the managers are typically from the communities as well. So there's those sort of tensions that make it a little, that introduce additional challenges in terms of really carefully managing the program. But it's definitely a process. And I think what you're talking about is where we need to go. Where we used to have no idea what was going on in the forest. Now we're at least monitoring what's going on. And then in the future, we need to be more proactively reacting to what's going on.
This will be the last question.
Yeah.
No, I'm just wondering if there's and you talk about maybe a real time component.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, because you know a lot of these parks are facing rangers being shot at.
Yeah.
Things like that.
So, yeah, definitely. That's the next big thing that we want to develop for SMART is real time communication between teams in the field and headquarters or ranger station or whatever. The primary challenge there is deciding or figuring out what technologies are going to work in a way that can be applied as broadly as possible. So like at Umbe, for example, there's basically no data network. There's no wireless. There's no way to remotely communicate other than with, say, a satellite phone. And there are no devices like this that have a satellite phone built into them. So you'd have to have two devices. You'd have to put a USB into one, get the data off, put it into a laptop, connect the laptop to the satellite phone, send the satellite phone. So there are other solutions. So like a lot of parks now have digital radio systems where the radios have GPS in them and they can communicate directly with a computer at the headquarters and you can see where the patrols are at any one time, but their ability to send data is relatively limited. So there are ways that you can do it by plugging a device into the radio, but it's very low. The bandwidth is very low, so you can't really send a lot of data. But yes, that's a long-winded answer to for sure. That's the number one thing that we want to develop in the future, but exactly how we're going to do it is still up for discussion. Okay, thanks very much. I'm happy to answer additional questions afterwards.